so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with our entomologist friend, Phil Pelletieri. We'll zero in a bit on fruit flies, on Asian lady beetles and stink bugs, but of course, Phil can answer pretty much any insect question you might have. He's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. So join with your questions for Phil. Tell us how you make sure your firewood is free of critters. What about home remedies for dealing with infestations? Join in, give a call. Or you could, and you could also send a photo and a question by email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And if you want to call, easy to do, just call us at 800-642-1234. Phil Pelletieri, good to have you back.
Nice to be back, Larry.
So fruit flies. We have a member of our team here that has been, whose name I won't say her name, but she is bombarded with fruit flies. Why do they show up this time of the year?
So a lot of times we bring them in the fall on produce and other things, and the confusing thing is where you see the adult flies is not where things are happening. The maggot stage feeds on yeast. Yeast is associating with overly ripe, over-fermenting, and even rotting things, and so that's where the fire is really going. But they show up in your wine glass and get in your eyes when you're, you know, washing dishes, that kind of thing, and trying to hunt it down. So, you know, some tomatoes that were brought in that were probably a little damaged could literally have breeding populations. At this time of the year, two things are going to happen. One, with this cold weather that's coming in the next week, you can absolutely assure that outdoors it's shut down. That's not the source. But I start worrying about gourds, pumpkins, onions, potatoes, things that are stored in the basement, because if some of those start to go out of condition, that can be the hot spot, and you can breed a lot of fruit flies in a small area. The other thing, recycling cans. If you don't wash them out, there's often enough sugar and things as that yeast attacks it and starts to break it down. That is a food substrate for the maggots, and so that's another thing that you have to look at. And even check your garbage cans and make sure something hasn't kind of leaked and caked on the bottom, because that, again, could be the source of all the fruit flies you see in the house.
Yeah, and there are different types of fruit flies, and I think each has its own personal taste. I know, for example, the spotted wing fruit fly enjoys berries.
Yeah, and you know, that is an import from Asia that came in the state about 10 years ago, and that one really is homes in. What makes it a real stinker, it likes to lay its eggs in the berries before they even ripen. So that's a little bit unusual in their biology, and they can be quite destructive to raspberries in particular. Thank goodness they don't get into thicker skin fruit like cranberries and apples, because they would be a widespread pest if they could do that. But, yeah, I mean, most of our indoor fruit fly type of things, there's three or four main species, and again, as you mentioned, there's some that honestly we even get out of garbage disposals in floor drains that get caking organic matter. They really get into the high end of the decay. Other ones are just getting slightly overripe, soft type of fruit. So,
what's the solution for getting rid of them or getting them out of your home?
Well, you know, people will use fruit fly traps, which are often just a little bit of beer or wine, anything we yeast to it, because, again, that's what attracts. But as I mentioned, all you're doing is pulling the adults out of the system. You really got to be a detective and kind of hunt down these things and use your nose. One of the names that entomologists call fruit flies are vinegar flies. And when you get that overly ripe vinegary, you know, type smell, that tells you you're close to the kind of things that they could possibly be breeding on.
Chris in Black Creek has something that relates right to this. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Larry. So years ago, I mistakenly made this discovery, and it works really good. I still do it, take a plastic bag, like a kitchen garbage bag, and literally put, I know you guys said don't have fruit sitting around, but I'd put a piece of fruit or whatever it is in the bottom of the bag, have the bag open at the top, and they'll even find their way in there at night. And then I sneak up on the bag and quick close top of it, take it outside, and either throw it away or open it up and give them to the neighbors.
Well, I could see that would be a great way of drawing or even just sampling to see if you got a problem. And as I said, I've had people that just use a little bit of wine in a glass and put some soap in the fruit flies are foolish enough to land on the top and drown into it. But the bottom line is you really should not be seeing any numbers of fruit flies on a consistent basis unless there's a breeding source in the house. And as I said, you could definitely make that decision now because the outdoor breeding season is so close to being done. And once the freeze hits, it's over.
Yeah. Thanks again for that call. Lee in Green Bay will turn to you. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. This is a question I have. I have 20 acres, partially wooded, partially field. I don't use any type of chemicals around. What happened to my fireflies this year, my lightning bugs? I saw maybe three or four past years. I have hundreds of them out here in the field in different parts of the property.
I've heard from other people, too.
Right. I think with fireflies, what I often equate them to, the larval stage are predators on things like millipedes. Millipedes are extremely common in well-hydrated, moist organic soil. So when things get really dry, the millipede populations crash, and if they crash, that will crash the firefly. So to be honest, I'm expecting next year not to be overly impressive either because, as I said, so much of the state has had a drought problem. But that, I would think, would be the first thing that I would try to equate with a relationship is if their food source is gone, they're not going to do well. On the other hand, if you look at in the United States, we have about 45 or 50 relatively common and even other uncommon firefly species. And there has been general comments, like so many other insect populations, they have been on decline for the last couple, three decades. I'm sure is a bigger picture, but in the short term, as I said, if the millipedes aren't doing well, the fireflies won't do well.
Lee, thank you for calling. Cheryl in Berlin will give you a chance. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I've got a question. Do stink bugs, which we have tons of them hanging on our screens, do they look like they're wearing like a little shield of armor? They're kind of pretty?
That would be shaped like a shield is fine. And, you know, we have a number of native stink bugs, but the things have changed again in the last 10 years or so since the marmorated stink bug or Asian stink bug has come in. And the big problem with it is, like some of these other insects, the adults try to sneak into places in the fall to spend the winter. And so they become a major nuisance. And, I remember pictures in my files of people sweeping buckets up just to the ones that were on the outside of their house. I have not seen any cases quite that intense in Wisconsin, but generally they have been more and more problematic in the last 10 years. I don't assume it's going to get as bad as it did out east when they first got here. I think that would have already happened. But again, this is the time of the year that we basically, if any of these critters can get into your walls or attic, then you pay for it all winter long. And when you get a warm day in January and you got a couple stink bugs, they probably, crawl down through a light fixture or the like. So, it is good to knock them down or prevent them from getting in. The physical side is the best way to do it. Chemicals, they work somewhat, but they're really not the only answer. On the other hand, it's almost impossible to find every nook and cranny they can sneak into, so it does get to be quite frustrating.
And it does sound, with that shield shape that Cheryl described, it does sound like the marmorated stink bug.
Yeah, and timing is perfect. I've noticed, a handful at best around, so we don't have them too bad in my neighborhood right now, but as I said, just depending where you are, they are problematic on some things in the garden, like tomatoes and the like. But I think their biggest claim to fame is this nuisance value that they give us problems with.
Yeah. Cheryl, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jamie in Algoma, we'll turn to you. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning. I was wondering if there's a source where you can go to learn or to identify sounds of different insects. There are so many sounds out there, and you can never find the little buggers, and there are different ones.
Yeah, it's one of those unfortunate things. If you have an inkling of what it might be, You know, a lot of the crickets and longhorn grasshoppers and katydids and whatnot have very distinct sounds. And there are books that have recordings with them and the like that you can use. The one that I'm familiar with is called the Song of Insects. And came out, maybe about 10, 12 years ago. And said if you can get a hold of a copy, it even has, and this again dates it, it has a CD that you can put in with those sounds. But there are other critters that you can run into, and that's where it gets tough. If you knew it was a cicada of some sort, you can go to the University of Michigan, and they have a whole website that has all the cicadas in the U.S., and you can listen to their sounds. But as I said, if you take all the insects that are out there, there may be a book, but I'm not aware of it. But when I think of it, I try to go to those critters that are most likely to make sounds. And as I said, the crickets, the grasshoppers, and their relatives are a big player here. And that's why I find that Song of Insects book really quite good.
Yeah, I remember interviewing the author of the book many years ago. So apparently it must have been 10 or 12 years ago.
Right.
Jamie, thanks. Appreciate the call. Dan in Lone Rock, on to you. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm just calling. We've got a little acreage here, and we spend a lot of time in nature on our property, and we're pretty aware of where the different, ground bee nests and that sort of thing are. And we noticed something weird this year. Started out with this bumblebee nest that was kind of in the back corner of the barn. It seemed like it stopped noticing bees coming in and out maybe late July, early August. And then also a couple of there was a paper wasp. I don't know, was at the bald-faced hornet. The paper wasp that had a nest in our apple tree. It seemed like we stopped seeing activity there around the same time, maybe mid-August. And then also the two ground bee nests that were in trails. I mean, we pay attention to where those are, so we don't upset them. And, after we noticed these other ones kind of disappear, we went and checked on those, and nothing doing over there either. And so I, wondered, is there a relationship? I know maybe some of those wild bees can get the same parasites as the honeybees, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The bumblebee thing, there are species of bumblebees that honestly are done by with the end of July. That their populations, most of them go quite a bit later than that, but that's just one potential. I will say overall that the amount of bald-faced hornets and ground nesting yellow jackets and whatnots have been amazingly low, and I'm not quite sure why it is, but, we didn't have any trouble eating or drinking outside this late fall and the like, which is often where some of those ground nesting yellow jackets get to be a problem. All of the wasps and bees have their list of various diseases, predators, you name it. The predators would be more obvious. You'd see that the nests were ripped up or dug into or whatnot if something was after them. But I don't know anything that is broad spectrum enough to take everything out at once. As I said, it doesn't seem to work that way. And I wonder if it was more, again, these dramatic droughts in just weather cases that affected things, because as I said, I all along, whether it's Polistes paper wasps or the bald-faced hornets or the ground nesting yellow jackets, they have been probably as low as I can remember as far as numbers this year.
Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. We're talking about the world of insects with him. If you have a question, comment, maybe a photo of an insect you want to have identified, join on in the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email your question and or photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Looking at insects today on the show with our guest entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Questions, call us at 800-642-1234, or you could email to ideas@wpr.org. Mary from McGuanago emailed us. She says she always has earwigs, but she's been able to coexist with them. This year, their population greatly increased, and they decimated many of her annuals despite good normal maintenance. Population in the house also increased substantially. She normally reuses much of her container soil from year to year. Do earwigs lay eggs in this plant soil? If so, does she need to throw out all of her plant soil?
Yeah, I think an interesting observation, again, because the climate of this year was not what I expect. Earwigs like it lush in the spring, and although we had some moisture, it was definitely not lush as far as I was concerned. They're very interesting that the European earwig, which has been in the state now for probably close to 40 years or so, overwinters in the ground as females, and there's a little bit of maternal care going on in the ground in the spring. And usually we get towards the middle of end of May, and then these half-grown earwigs come out and start doing their thing. So I really don't think that there's much as far as potting soil or other things that would have a lot to do with it. The only thing, again, I would wonder, you know, if she's a person that really pampers her plants and in particular keeps them well watered, that would definitely change the equation, allow the earwig populations to do better. And then, of course, there's always that relationship. The more they're outside, the more they get inside and give you the frustrations of them hanging out, although we can assure people that they don't breed inside. I know we haven't had high populations in our backyard for a number of years, but I know my wife purposely went away from certain annuals, marigolds in particular. They were just terrible on it. And it's frustrating because you don't see them during the day most of the time. You just see the things disappear, and you might blame rabbits and other critters for eating your plants, and it's the darn earwigs. And we always used to suggest to folks to go out, you know, after the sun goes down with a flashlight and see what's going on, and you can usually pick it up. But, interesting year. I would not have expected that. And we'll see, you know, if you do protect your plants, it's that end of May, beginning of June. The later you go into the summer, their populations are in moderate decline, and usually it's not as important.
Barbara in Richland Center called, couldn't stay with us, but wonders, you were talking earlier about bees perhaps being decimated by drought. She wonders, how long does it take for bees to recover or recur when they're decimated by drought?
You know, each critter's got its, you know, almost all the yellow jackets and hornets and bumblebees included overwinter as single queens. And so if their queen numbers are low, you know, that's not good. But insects have this reproductive potential that if things go right the next year, the numbers can rebound quite quickly. Now, honeybees, it gets a little bit more difficult because they overwinter as colonies and there's more dynamic involved there. But honeybee is really the only one that overwinters as colonies that we deal with. All our others are we call solitary bees or wasps, and as they said, they're single individuals. And even the ones that don't make colonies, it's the same thing. It's usually the females are in cocoons or other, you know, dormant life stages, and then emerge and start things going. So the good news is because of their reproductive potential, their populations will come back quite a bit quicker than when we think of birds and other things that their generation time is quite a bit longer, plus the number of offspring is lower. They don't have this potential to come back as fast.
Jeff in Berry Mills has a question. Let's go to Jeff. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about my pet wolf spider. He's sitting, he had a nice large web just outside of my screen porch. And for a while there last month, early this month, I was swatting all the hornets that got on the porch and drop them in his web. And he'd have those little suckers wrapped up in less than a minute. It was really kind of fun to watch.
Sure. So, it might be worth looking, though. So wolf spiders typically don't make nests. They're a nighttime hunting spider. But the big one that's fun to play with is a whole group of what we call orb weaver spiders. And lots of different sizes. So it might be worth taking a look at the critter you saw and see if you can see something that matches it. But it would fit more of the behavior of the adult female orb weaver spiders that we see in the late summer that make the big nests, and some of them are incredible photographic subjects because they got oranges and cream-colored dots and all kinds of interesting stuff. Most of the wolf spiders are gray, big, hairy, scary-looking things, and as I said, they typically are nighttime hunters, and you don't associate them with webs.
Jeff, does that help, or did you have something to add there?
Yeah, well, he was out during the daytime a lot, but now I see, now that the weather's cool off, he's only coming out at night now, even when the weather is really cool. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Sure. So, you know, this type of spider will lay an egg sac, and that's how these spiders get through the winter. And then the little spiders hatch in the spring, and then they tend to disperse. But it isn't till, I usually don't find it until the late summer, that they start to mature and they start to make the big webs. And you know, one of the fun things to do is go out on a real heavy dew morning to see all the numbers of spider webs that are out in some of these, you know, grassland fields and whatnot. It's just absolutely amazing to me sometimes. And, of course, people take photographic images that are really quite impressive when you get those conditions. Mm-hmm. But said it might be worth looking because there's a whole bunch of these orb web spiders, you know, the black and yellow garden spiders, shamrock spiders, as I said. And it was one of the more common things that people would send me because, you know, wolf spiders are big and almost look like baby tarantulas, whereas these orb web species, you know, they're big, and that scares some people, but they're not big and hairy, and as I said, they're often colorful. So I think people tend to be more respectful, and, you know, ultimately Charlotte's Web has a big star that was an orb weaver spider.
Jeff, thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Harry in West Bend next. Hi, Harry.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been having problems with cluster flies up at my cabin up north. We've gone, you know, August, September, and when I, at night they're not a problem, but in the daytime when it warms up, there's thousands on our porch window, and we try to vacuum them all up, and they keep coming back. And eventually what I had to do was open up the screens and the windows and just let them fly away.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to get rid of them.
Okay, so unfortunately it's a timing issue when you're about a month and a half to 2 months late. So cluster flies, by nature, are earthworm parasites. They breed on earthworms. But in the fall of the year, and this starts usually the end of August and the early part of September, they start to seek shelter. And they're working up in underneath your siding or up in the attic wall void spaces, and then you kind of wake them up is what happens when you heat or the like. And so you continue to pay for that. And as I said, what the concern is now is we're late enough. I know they're not continuing to migrate in. You're just seeing how many really got in. So you take a step back and look for the long run. Is there any, is this a log-type cabin or what kind of construction?
And it's old. It's about 100 years old. So.
And it's okay. A log cabin, did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, you honestly have to look through the chinking, but if I had to direct you where you would concentrate, usually if your overhangs, the soffits and the like, because the cluster flies will land on the side of the building, and then when often it's cold enough they can't even move, but when it warms up, the sun hits them, they start crawling upwards, and that's when they're squeezing into things. So looking at, you know, stuffing, using some kind of caulking or the like, at any kind of seam, and it doesn't need to be a very big seam, but as I said, in your soffit overhangs, if you've got any kind of vents, make sure that the screening on that is small enough that critters can't squeeze through. And if you can figure out the riddle of how they're getting in, you don't worry about cluster flies ever again. But the problem, again, in an old building, there is lots of places. The same thing in old farmhouses. The other interesting dynamic is it depends. You can have a neighbor, exact same construction. They're not seeing any cluster flies. The difference usually is the more exposed and out in the open, the more problems you get. If something's in the middle of the woods surrounded by shady trees, the sun never hits it, that's not a place that cluster flies seem to be able to find, and so they don't come into. But real frustrating critter because you can get buckets of them. I have seen attic pictures of them being 6 inches deep in an attic. You know, and so you can just imagine the number of flies, and you will pay for that all the way until next spring into April when they finally either they died, which isn't the best because the ones that die can be food for carpet beetles and other kinds of nuisance problems, and then they eventually move out, and then again, you don't see them until the following fall.
Harry, thank you so much. Good luck checking out for spots where they might get in.
So the other thing, Larry, people do spray for them, and they spray the outside. No reason to spray inside because they've already got past your barriers. But again, if you were to spray, you have to spray in that August, early September. And there are various sprays for this that if they land on the source, they will die before they get in, is what the theory.
Thanks again, Harry. Joslyn in Stratford, your turn. Hi.
Hi. My concern is I have lots of old trees on my property, and in one place on the lawn, there's a huge tree root that sticks out of the ground, and there's a hole near it right next to it, and my riding lawnmower, the wheel kept getting hung up in that. So I put a lot of topsoil in there and planted grass. And later on, I was mowing over that. And I saw what looked like honeybees all over. And I watched, and the honeybees had made a hole down into near that tree root. And
sure.
So I stopped mowing near that.
Sure.
But I haven't seen them lately, but there's still that hole there down into where those bees are. And what happens to them now over winter?
Sure. I don't think it's honeybees because honeybees, although they will nest in hollow trees, are not really ground-digging critters. But what you describe fits exactly what people often will refer to ground bees, but they're not. They're a type of ground-nesting paper wasp, and they use old rodent burrows and similar things. And inside that hole is a gray paper nest, just like the ones you see up in the trees. But this group is a ground nester for doing this. And their populations die off usually by the time we get into early November. And the new queens start everything from scratch. So, I wonder if with filling this, it probably took away some of the hole. But they're not the best diggers. They can't start from scratch and dig the hole, but if there is a pre-existing hole, gopher burrow or something similar, that's what they get into. And it's a similar thing that bumblebees like to nest into, too. So it's good news that they've stopped. What I always tell people is go out in the middle of a warm day. If they're active, you should see them coming and going in big numbers. And if you don't see that, that sounds like the colony is pretty much in decline, if not died off. But it would be a good idea to do what you did, again, is to get some soil and fill that in so you're basically removing that option for any critters that are looking to start a nest next year.
Good luck, Joslyn. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Susan in Jefferson. Your turn, Susan. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. Question. I was trimming my bushes this spring, and all of a sudden these big black flying, I don't even know what they are. I had an exterminator even come and look to try and get rid of them. But they chased me and they stung me, and I had to like pull them off of me to get rid of them when they chased me down the street. And I was just wondering what they were. They looked sort of like a great big black ant. They were about maybe 2/3 of an inch.
Huh. That's strange.
There are ants. We don't have really true stinging ants in Wisconsin. We have some ants that are capable of biting, but they wouldn't gang up on you like that, especially chase you in the wing form. If you mess with the nest, they nip at you a little bit. Once you leave them alone, they leave you alone. So this sounds more in the wasp and bee group in particular. I know it's probably more midsummer. I was pruning a bush at home, and I got zapped, and I knew it was a bumblebee, but I was wondering what the heck, because again, bumblebees typically will leave you alone unless you bother with a nest. I'm looking at the ground expecting to have a nest there, and what it turned out to be is that it was an old abandoned bird nest that the bumblebees were nesting in, and by shaking and cutting and whatnot in the bush, they took offense at that and chased. So the good news is that you wouldn't expect it to reoccur. those kind of critters die out now with this kind of weather. There's nothing for them to eat. They couldn't survive if they wanted to, even if it stayed warm. If there's nothing to eat, the populations crash. But that's what I would look for, is some kind of thing like a bird nest in the bush that could support the nest of particularly bumblebees. It wouldn't surprise me, although I typically don't see any kind of wasp utilizing that environment. Your description sounds more wasp-like, because wasp and ants are really quite similar in the constriction and their the middle of their body and the like. You know, bees, if you look at closely, tend to be on the fuzzy side, whereas wasps and ants aren't.
Susan, thank you very much for calling. Isla in Little Chute, your turn. Hi, Isla.
Hi there. I've just noticed today first some box elder bugs on my screens. Is there something I'm doing that's attracting them, or are they just a nuisance?
They're a nuisance, but like a lot of these fall things, it's, you know, if they can find their way in, then they're a nuisance all winter long. You know, box elder bugs, I was talking to PJ, who is, you know, runs the diagnostic lab now, and, you know, the weather pattern generally is dry late summers give us tons of box elder bugs. I have not seen that myself. I asked PJ, and he said, too, the numbers are low, but that doesn't mean that still some people don't see some. And when they get crazy, your whole siding can be absolutely covered with them. They will congregate on the sunny sides of the house. Again, I expect them to be quite happy the next couple days, but with this dramatic weather change, it's going to just shut the door. So if you've not had a lot of problems, that's good news, because I would have expected them to bother you for the last 3 to 4 weeks at minimum. One option, though, you've got is you can spray them with soapy water. I mean, they are susceptible to soap sprays. And so sometimes we find that, you know, people can go out there and spray them on a sunny afternoon when they're clustered as a way of knocking their numbers down and without having to use other kinds of chemicals.
Yeah. I found one box elder bug on the sunny side of my home, and that was it in the last week, and I've been kind of looking to see.
Yeah, you know, and so the dynamic there is they've got two generations a year. They feed primarily on box elder seed, but they also, since box elder is a maple, silver maple is another plant that can support them. And they're a natural insect here, native insect, but they get this fungus disease, and the fungus disease relates to how much moisture. So in dry years, the fungus disease isn't near as active, and we get bigger numbers. And as I said, I am somewhat perplexed that we aren't having more of a problem than we're seeing, just because as dry as things were and the rains came too late to really help us too much. So,
Isla, thank you again. Rick and Monona, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I'm so glad I caught your show today. Last summer, we had an experience with bald-faced hornets. We never ever saw them before. They're black and white. The story is this. They were up in a tree in a huge nest. We were just fascinated. And then there was a big storm one night, and the next day we found it laying next to the tree on the ground. And so we just sort of watched it, and we read about them, and we thought they were fascinating, and we actually put a fence around it so we could watch them, and they wouldn't bother anyone. And then here's the question that I have that this blew our minds. We came out one morning, and we looked, and some critter had attacked the hive and tore it apart. It was in pieces, and I thought, I know how fierce those bald-faced hornets are, and I'm just wondering what critter would invade that, and somebody suggested that it could have been for the larvae, but still, I imagine that's a critter that's face is probably still swollen from sting.
Yeah, so the two critters we point at most often are skunks and raccoons. And it is amazing that they can tolerate the stings, because you know how aggressive they get. And you hit it on the head. They're going after that high-protein food source that the larvae are there in. Usually up in the trees, they're relatively safe. When they're on the ground, they're more like sitting ducks, because they really don't. And I agree with you. I am surprised that critters can munch at that and tolerate the stings, because if you've ever gotten a sting, you know, they're very painful initially, you know, that first hour or two, and it's something most people would want to avoid. You know, when I often would get the calls when we start to drop leaves and people would find nests, you know, that they didn't know existed 2 feet from the bedroom window, and they never bothered anybody. And that's the thing we always used to weigh as far as having to deal with them. You know, if they're 15 feet up in the tree, why bother? You've got no problem. Your biggest risk is when you're bothering the nest. If it's 3 feet away from your front door, then, you know, somebody, a kid or a pet, could bump into it, and they have to be dealt with. So, but as I said, it's amazing when you do watch them that they really are very tolerant, unless they feel the nest is threatened, and then it goes the other way. They really are quite aggressive. And, you know, again, I think we all know stories of neighbors and whatnot that got into really bad cases of whether it's ball-faced hornet or the ground nesting, which is a very close relative. It's just a smaller species, more, you know, honeybee size, and they make the paper wasp nest in the ground, and those are the ones that often when people are lawn mowing and whatnot, from the end of August on, we have problems with.
Yeah, I had the hornets build a nest in a half a bag of soil that I had, you know, I thought I had it closed up, but I apparently didn't have it closed up well enough, and I got a rude shock when went to that.
You know, you can have 2,000 individuals in a nest when they're at their strongest, and so it can really get quite dangerous in some circumstances and as far as dealing with the stings.
Yeah, I had about 10 stings, so it was not fun. Thanks, Rick. Dennis in Two Rivers, hi.
I have an observation and a question. Back in the 1980s, there was some sap from a tree on my car, and there were flies on it. When I swatted the flies, yellow jackets grabbed the flies, and they were taking off with them. And another thing with yellow jackets is there were some that were I don't know if they were eating the raspberries or maybe if they were going after the little caterpillars or whatever that might be in raspberries. I was wondering what you might think about that.
It could be either or, although you do see in you know, wasp diets are both protein and sugar. And in the late summer, when you know, we get apples dropping and all that other stuff, you see all kinds of yellow jacket activity on the fruit as they're taking it. And as I said, they're getting sugar out of that. It's not the best. And sugar is more for their short-term energy needs, whereas the protein is more to feed their young and raise populations. So, the fly thing, very much so. In fact, Dr. Bob Jean was a colleague of mine that he and his students did all kinds of neat studies on yellow jackets and wasps, both in the Amazon, but also here. And you know, he had his students go out and collect ball-faced hornet's nests early, before the numbers were large, and they brought them into the garden. And what they documented is the large number of cabbage worms and other leaf-eating caterpillars that these things would prey upon and reduce their numbers. And it's just a natural part of their prey, but so are flies. And as you see, they go there and just the poor fly. No, I shouldn't say poor fly. The fly is sitting on the fence post, not minding its own business, and all of a sudden the yellow jacket will come, and the fly's got no defense. Yellow jackets, interesting enough, not quite as fancy as honeybees, but literally can find a food source and do a bit of communication with its nest mates so that they continue to come and exploit. It's kind of like they learn that there's a free lunch here. And so, again, it wouldn't be surprising if they learn that there's a bunch of flies on the side of the barn, that they're every day picking up flies.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist. He's actually a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. And great to have him with us. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mailer. Phil, have you had a chance to look at some of the email photos that came in?
Yeah, lots of good ones. we'll start. The first one is a critter that was found in July. Looks like it could have been a garage floor. This is what my grandson calls a roly-poly. It is a sow bug, which are critters that are normally found in the soil. If you were to turn one over, you know, insects have six legs. These guys have more than six legs. But they're really harmless little critters. They feed on organic matter, but they wander around, and so sometimes they show up in basements and the like. Definitely nothing to worry about. But, you know, there are other critters that look very similar, and, you know, what we're looking for is, you know, how many legs, how many antennae, those kind of things, which give us, you know, an idea of what it is. And this is a different kind of arthropod. It's not a true insect, but a critter, and as I said, definitely nothing to worry about.
You mentioned legs and antennae, and Judith had emailed us a photo of one with looks like lots of antennae and legs.
Yeah, okay, so this is another one of the relatively new critters. We call it a western conifer seed bug. Some people would call it a stink bug, but compared to the stink bug we talked about earlier, it's more elongated and stretched, so it isn't quite as shield-shaped. It has very distinctive legs. It comes from a family that we call the leaf-footed bugs because there's a flaring of the hind legs that make them, in some cases, look like small leaves, not quite as much. But as the name is, they're a seed feeder on conifer trees, spruces in particular, but their claim to fame is they come indoors in the fall, just not quite the numbers of some of these other things, but enough to sometimes be a problem. And if you handle them, they have a very distinct odor. It catches your attention as a defense mechanism by the critter. I don't say it's a pleasant odor, but it's not a foul odor either, you know, like a decaying dead animal type of thing. And so that's one of the things. If you pick them up, they will, and she had mentioned it smelled like citrus to her, and that would be, I think, a little more descriptive. And again, like these typical fall critters, we look figure out what they're doing, but the bottom line is they're nuisance problems. They're, you know, none of these things will breed in your house, but when you get a bunch of them, that tells them they had a very easy time getting in.
Let's take a call from John and Mason next. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have a comment and a question. My comment is I read somewhere a long time ago, and I believe it's true, that paper wasps, after you get rid of the wasp, you leave the nest up, and they're territorial, so no other wasp will come near it or make another nest near it. And I've done that ever since I read this, and I think it's true. In fact, I've even seen where you can buy a fake nest to hang and keep them away.
You know, I would be more suspicious if the nest was active, that the workers and whatnot would be aggressive enough to not put up with much with neighbors. But just the way their visual stuff uses, we don't, we have a relatively new species of European paper wasp in the Polistes group that literally will reuse its old nest, which when I first heard about that, that caught my attention because that's so unusual. But generally speaking, I've heard that comment before, that they act as a repellent, but I've really not seen any science that would suggest that that's going on. I think just the way their vision is, I'm not sure they would respond to it the same way as we do, you know, where it's quite obvious. I think just, they just go about doing their business. And as I said, if there was competitors around, live competitors, there's a problem, but just a nest there, probably not.
John, thanks. Let's go to another John, this time in near Portage. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, we were redoing a garden that had been neglected for before we purchased our house and found that we had a lot of what we identified later, I think, as cicada killers. They look like wasps, probably as big as your thumb. It's the biggest ones I've ever seen in my life. And they burrow holes in the garden, and we've actually seen them pulling live cicadas down into the holes, you know, two or three of them at a time. It's pretty incredible, and we wanted to get rid of them, but what we have heard and learned is that they don't bother people, and that's what we found, is they look menacing, but they just fly, you know, they just fly out of the way. So I was just wondering what else you could tell me about cicada killers.
Well, typically they're looking for that open kind of ground. So, you know, there's been cases where we've had trouble in people's lawns, and we direct them to seed and fertilize and make the lawn lush, and they won't go into it. In the case of around flower beds and bushes, you know, putting more mulch on tends to discourage them because they're looking for the bare soil. You mentioned they're big and scary. They're the biggest, scariest-looking wasp we've got, and they do come back to the same areas. And one of the things that goes on is the males are territorial. So if you go walking in an area, you see this very large, what appears to be aggressive wasp coming after you, and it's just the male checking you out. And as typical, males do not have stingers in most of the wasp and bee and ant group, so nothing to worry about. But again, most people would misread the behavior as this is coming to get me. And so, as I said, I mean, one of the things you might look at if you thought they were problematic is playing around with kinds of mulch in the garden that would prevent the bare soil, or you can just leave them. But I do expect them to continue to come back to the same spot. That's a pretty characteristic. But this is not a true nest in the sense you've got a queen and all the critters that come out of there are her offspring. Those are the colony kinds of bees and wasps. Those are the ones that are aggressive. These are what we would call solitary. Even though you might have two or three females using the same initial hole, they have little chambers off to the side where they stuff the cicada, lay its egg, and then the grub feeds on its own and then emerges the following year. And you don't see the first cicada killers till you get into early July, which is when the cicadas come out. So there's perfect timing with that.
Interesting. John, thanks for calling. Anson in Cary, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Anson.
Hi, Larry. Good to hear from you. I have a question about, sorry about that. I got a call. Are you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry about that. I had a question about this interesting behavior I see with flies outside in the summertime. If I'm out working, doing any kind of construction work with an electric saw, typically a table saw or something, I have run that saw and cutting through a piece of wood. As soon as you fire up the saw, all these flies show up, and they sit on the saw or on the wood, and when I'm done, they leave. It's almost like they can sense a vibration or something. I don't know what kind of flies they are, but have you ever heard of that kind of behavior before?
Okay, I'm guessing at this one, but there are various insects that find their mates by various frequencies and the like, and I wonder if you're just hitting a certain frequency with that. That it's attractive to them, that they honestly go on it. It really is more common. You know, mosquitoes do this. It's interesting when you dig in, more insects than you would think utilize wing beat frequencies and the like, which give you a certain tone to find each other. So that's a guess on my part.
Pretty good guess, though.
Yeah.
Anson, there you go. Nancy in Grafton, hello.
Hey, when I was a little girl, I had to go and get the cows, and they went through a swamp, and I had to chase them out of the swamp, and gosh darn it, I stepped in a mud hornets, and I got stung all over with these mud hornets, but I reached down in that swamp, and I wiped up all that mud and the manure, and I put it all over my arms, my face, everything. I came home with the cows. My dad said, "What happened to you? You look like something that starts with S-H anyhow." And I says, "Yeah." And so then I washed all that stuff off. No swelling, never ever itching or anything. It was like it never happened.
Interesting. Well, you know, the thing that is problematic about hornets is, you know, honeybees, when they sting, have a barb on their stinger. And so literally what often happens is when they pull away, it rips their abdomen apart. So they only sting you once is what the story is. Yellow jackets and hornets, it's a needle, and they'll sting you multiple times given the opportunity. And so that makes, again, things quite frustrating. But it's interesting, you know, people do have home remedies of putting baking soda and meat tenderizer and other things on, and, you know, it's often speculated that that affects some of the venom that is left behind. And, of course, how much you hurt differs with individuals, but it really also is related to the kinds of different venoms, and some of them hurt more than others. And sometimes they get more venom in you than others, and so you sometimes get these different responses. But that's interesting that you know, people would say draw out. I don't know, but was it the pH of that mixture that neutralized the venom or something? But it does sound like it did affect, it prevented that from really causing you the kind of pain that you normally would expect.
Yeah. See, if it had been in the days of cell phones with photos possibilities, you probably would have had your picture taken by your dad. Nancy, oh, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, our guest. It's great to have him with us, and he will be with us up until 12:30 today. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Glad to have you with us today. I'm Larry Mueller, and callers online, so I think we'll just go back to the phones and to Christina in Glenwood. Christina, thank you for waiting.
Hi there, thank you. I have two quick questions. One is, I've had yellow jackets nesting in the aluminum siding. I leave them alone. They've gotten into the basement. I just open the window and they leave. But just recently, there was one that was much larger than the other. So I'm wondering, is that a queen?
So what happens in the end of summer is they produce the new queens, and they produce males for the first time. Most of the population, most of the year, are all females. And those queens will mate in the fall. And then they crawl under a rock or in an attic or whatnot, and then spend the winter that way. Everybody else dies off, and then they start. So that's probably the biggest distinguishing character, is they are much larger, and it was probably a new queen. I'm guessing she had not mated yet, because typically they have to leave and mate, and they do not come back. So that would fit. And you know, that's the problem when they're in the siding or attic is, the good news is we're late enough in the season that we're within days of them just being totally done, because they've been in decline for some time. But as I said, now with the cold temperatures, they absolutely will run out of food and everybody starves. But when sometimes what people will do is plug the outside hole before dealing with the nest, and that forces them inside. And I have literally had cases where they've eaten through the wall to get access. And, of course, that's quite problematic when you've got dozens, if not hundreds, of angry yellow jackets. If somebody's forced to treat, because you don't know where the nest, this is exactly the same as a ground nesting paper wasp. They're just ground nesting in your spacing in your walls or your attic. It's best to use the dust rather than the spray, because the dust kind of coats the opening when they come and go, and you usually don't treat unless it's right away in the morning or late at night after when they're really less active. But again, my recommendation this late in the year, don't bother. Other than if it was a little more problematic, if you could figure where they're squeezing through on your sill plate or in your wall, and again, just physically, you know, whether you have to put some tape or something just to stop from doing that in the short, you know, week or two at best, that they will remain active.
Well, Christina, I hope that helps. Thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate it. Janet in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Phil. We have an area of the yard we use for the dog. And so whenever I'm back there picking up after the dog, I always kind of marvel at how flies will collect on the dog waste. And so I was hoping Phil could explain why they do that. What is the appeal of manure and waste?
Well, it's high in organic matter. And the confusing thing for all of us is there's a whole bunch of flies that look alike that have very different behaviors. But the ones associated with dead animals or animal waste have incredible sensing mechanisms that they can sense very quickly when there is a food source. And if you left it unattended, they would lay eggs. In fact, in some cases, they don't even, they give birth to live young to speed the process so that their maggots can quickly, and we're talking in a matter of 4 or 5 days, devour that food source and continue on with their life cycle. So they're always out there looking for the right circumstances. And again, thank goodness these things are there, because that's the natural recycling. If it wasn't there, we would have piles of all kinds of animal waste around there, and we don't. And it does show you really how effective it is. Some great studies done in Africa about elephant waste and how quickly it is buried between the beetles and the flies and everything else. And as I said, that dynamic on a smaller scale plays out with all kinds of animal waste.
Yeah, and Janet, if you've never been in a pasture, horse pasture or a cow pasture, you would see that those flies in action for sure.
Yeah, in fact, a crazed entomologist like to go out in the pastures because there are some of the most amazing-looking beetles that also do the same, some of the dung beetles. But you have to tip over the cow pies to find what you're looking for. And so, again, people look at us quite strangely when we're out there.
Don emailed us from Green Bay, pleasantly surprised when he sees a dragonfly in his yard. He doesn't live too far from the bay itself. How far of a range will a dragonfly travel? And also, what can he do to encourage them to visit more often?
Yeah, boy, I don't know a whole lot to track them. You know, we have dragonfly species. In fact, I honestly got a couple emails about this earlier in the summer where the dragonflies were seen in almost clouds. They were, you know, large numbers working together, and a lot of them turned out to be the green darner dragonfly, which literally will migrate up here from central U.S. So we're talking they can technically go hundreds of miles and then migrate farther south again when we get into the late summer and fall. More typically, though, you're talking, I'm guessing, at best an area of a mile. You know, it works well to be near an aquatic source because, of course, that's what dragonflies breed in, but also all the little gnats and whatnot. I mean, there's so many critters associated with water and swamps and the like that's just a better place to forage. And that's typically what you'll see. We've got some golf horse ponds within a couple blocks of where I live, and the dragonflies I see, I equate with those. And, you know, they're sitting on rock walls and whatnot, just waiting for flies and other things to come by and pick them up. But they got to get back to that water source if they have any possibility of breeding.
Mary in Milwaukee says she and her friends have been getting tons of box elder bugs this year. They've tried to seal up where they're coming in, but it hasn't worked for some of the neighbors. Any other suggestions?
Well, again, you know, the home remedy is there are insecticidal soaps that you could spray on the sunny days that they're clustered. And as I said, what we've talked about, we're unfortunately a couple weeks past where that's going to be overly effective. And the other side, there are pest control services that will offer fall nuisance insect control. And what they do is they come in and spray your overhangs and your soffits and the little cracks and crevices. But it's all about timing. And, you know, for the cluster flies that we had a call earlier in the show on, the timing is first week of September. For the ladybugs and the box elder bugs and whatnot, I think you can go to the end of September into early October. Typically, if you got a three-story house, it's just almost impossible for people to do that themselves. And that's where, if it's really problematic, a professional way to do it is, but go back to much as they're trying. If you solve the riddle of how they're getting in, then you don't have to spray. You've got it solved every year. If you rely on the sprays, whether it's the soap or whatnot, that has to be done every fall.
And an email with a photo from Ross in Crawford County. He's looking for an ID on this spider he saw, impressive looking, by the way. He saw it about 3 weeks ago. And he's also wondering what's a good general insect book for the Midwest where one can narrow down, maybe even identify insects that one sees.
So Ross did a great job taking the picture, because if you would have showed me just the front half of this spider, I would probably go in the different direction. When we get into spider IDs, we got to look at their eyes, how they're orientated. And when I saw this two dark brown stripes on the thorax, there are some wolf spiders that have that. But this is not a wolf spider. This is a grass spider. It is a smaller spider. you know, and unless you got a coin or something as reference, you miss it. But what gives it away on the tail end of the spider, there are two little, what look like antennae. We call them cerci. And cerci are not found on wolf spiders that you can see, but they're very common in grass spiders. Now, the ID book, what's problematic is that there's so many, so few books that do justice to everything. But the Peterson Field Guide series I found quite good, and there are even specific ones that have things like butterflies or moths and the like. And so that would be what the other one is. A colleague of mine up in the University of Minnesota, Jeff Hahn, who is also retired now, but he's done a couple nice field guides up in northern Minnesota on various insects, and those are pretty reasonable books. But if you really get serious, it's best to get one very specific, one on just dragonflies, one on just moths, those kind of things.
Let's take a call. Roy in Whitewater, what's on your mind?
Hi, I hope my question is pertinent to this show on entomology. It's about gypsy moths, now called fluffy moths or
spongy
moths. Thank you. Last spring and summer, I spent an enormous amount of time oiling egg masses, burning larvae, and destroying pupae cocoons, which happily did result in a much less devastation than the year before. I have two questions. Would there be any advantage in oiling these egg masses yet this fall before snowfall? And two, is there an eventual end to this onslaught?
What do you think, Phil? Oh, did we lose Phil? Oh, we must have lost Phil. Well, we'll get him back, and we'll get him back in just a minute. Phil Pelletieri, our guest entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, our guest today. And Roy in Whitewater has a good question about spongy moths, and I think we'll be able to get that back in just a minute. Just to mention while we're – is he back? Just while we're waiting for that to happen, a reminder that tomorrow you can join us for another edition of our book club. This time we talk with Ron Rindo. He's written a great book. It's a haunting book. It's titled Breathing Lake Superior, and it looks at the mental strain of grief when it comes becomes entangled with the promise of hope and ecstatic faith. That's tomorrow. It's a fascinating book, and I really hope if you've read it, please feel free to please join in. If you haven't read it, you're going to learn a lot about the book, and you're going to probably want to get yourself a copy of it. But that's tomorrow, and he'll be with me live in the studio. So really looking forward to talking with Ron Rindo. And let's see, we're still working on getting...
I'm here, Larry.
Oh, you're back? Okay, good.
Okay, so where I lost the call, the gentleman was talking about spongy moth, and he was wondering about using oil on the egg masses. You can do that now. It's a good idea when they're accessible. And then again, next spring, if you miss some, that's still fine. Although I think I would have more faith doing it now. It gives more opportunity. And so... You know, we're nervous. This was the worst spongy moth year outbreak we've seen. It's all weather-related. The dry springs don't kill the caterpillars off like we want, and so we're kind of set up hoping for more moisture in March and April, but we'll see. But, yeah, definitely anything you can do and go out and inspect. In fact, again, I was talking to PJ this morning, and he was telling me that, you know, in his close to where he lives, there was quite a bit of activity, but he didn't see any egg masses. And that's been my experience when I'm walking around the west side of Madison. I'm not seeing egg masses, but I know where some hot spots were. And what he shared with me is he was doing some pruning on an apple tree. And when he got down where all the suckers were, sure enough, there was about six or seven gypsy moth egg masses.
Oh.
So they can be out there, and they're pretty good at least when their numbers are high, they're very obvious. But when they're moderate, they're pretty good at hiding them. And so let's keep our guard up. And again, in a perfect world, we're going to get the moisture we need to knock them down. 3 or 4 year dry years in a row is the kind of things that make the moth populations explode.
Thanks, Roy, for calling. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I know you're running short of time, so I'll be quick. We've always had a few fruit flies around our tightly closed compost container in the kitchen, but all of a sudden the last few weeks have just been hordes, and like a lot of things, it's a matter of degree. Is there anything to do about that?
Oh. Again, I think you got to hunt this down because there is a fire in the house is probably the way to put it, and I'm not convinced. You know, the giveaway, the maggots are very small, but definitely visible. And if they were in the compost, you should see small little maggots crawling. In fact, they've got this very interesting little breathing tube that kind of sticks out from them. That would prove that they were breeding in the compost, or indeed, if you didn't see that, then is it something else? And, you know, I go back to, because of the time of the year, squash and stuff that are stored in the basement, you forget about. There might be one bad one in there, and you can't imagine how many fruit flies you can breed from a two-pound squash.
There you go, Rick. Just to go along with that, we had an email from Pauline. She washes off all fruits and vegetables she brings home from the grocery store with a kind of vinegar water bath and stores everything, including potatoes, in the refrigerator. And still has this fruit fly issue. She poured boiling water down the kitchen drains, cleaned everything with peroxide and water in a spray bottle, but they're still around. Does she need to do more?
No, it will run its course. They run out of food. But I'll just throw, you know, one of these wild ones that you see. We found a breeding population in the drain pan of a refrigerator, and it got slimy and soupy in there. And again, it must have had enough organic matter to support the yeast that supported the maggots. And so that's the kind of frustrating source you can run into. There's got to be moisture. They cannot breed on dry stuff. There's got to be some kind of sugar or protein for the yeast to work on, and that's we talk about the fermenting and stuff. The only time I've ever really seen them breed in garbage disposals is when they're not used. We've had some problems on campus in the summer when they shut down some of the cafeterias. All of a sudden we get this explosion, and lo and behold, you find in the corner there was a garbage disposal that hadn't been used for the last 3 weeks, and it had enough organic matter. And they'll turn their generation in a matter of a few days, and so it happens quickly. But it always goes back to, I know we're at that point that if they continue to be there, they can't be coming through the screens outside. They got to be breeding inside. And then it's the case of being enough of a detective using moisture and organic matter as the two driving forces that allow the maggots to get going.
Just put a new garbage disposal in. It had installed in my house, as you mentioned that. And my quick word of advice is don't let anybody put a spoon down the garbage disposal when it's running. It doesn't help the garbage disposal at all.
Or the spoon.
Oh, man. Or the spoon. You're right about that. Jean emailed, there's some dark brown spots on the siding of their house. They look like just a spot of paint. I know what she's talking about. When they scrape them off, they still leave a residue behind. Could this be some kind of scale?
It sounds like a scale, but it's not. I'm guessing that this is something we call artillery fungus, and it's the spores. And artillery fungus, as the name implies, shoots its spores. They are dark. They are round. Some people mistake them for spider waste or other insect waste. But one of the characteristics is they are extremely tough on the siding. I mean, they're hard to get off. Sometimes they discolor the paint. Again, she mentioned she gets some discoloring. Usually the source is bark mulch because the fungus is breeding on the bark mulch and shooting the spores up. The tough thing is that it's moisture-related also because if things are dry, the bark mulch is not supporting artillery fungus. But if you've got plants there, you're watering your plants, and it's a tough one. You know, do you change the kind of mulch you've got? Do you just put up with it? You know, it helps to wash, but, you know, nobody wants to be washing their house once a week because the spores tend to get more like cement the longer they sit there, has been my experience.
Yeah. A listener from Maquanago emailed, they put their dog on the deck for 15 or 20 minutes or so yesterday afternoon. Later in the afternoon, he started vomiting, the dog that is. Vomiting is kibble, but among the kibble were box elder bugs he'd swallowed. Must have eaten a dozen or so. They called their vet and they advised the listener that they were not toxic. and to monitor and provide the dog with a bland diet if needed. After vomiting, the dog seemed okay, but would you get sick from eating box elder bugs?
It could happen. I agree. They're not toxic. I had the same question thrown at me about Asian lady beetles, but it wasn't eating. It was people that were crushing them in their hands, and they ended up getting intestinal disorders associated with. Now, we're not talking one or two. They were doing a bunch of them type of thing. And although I never saw a documentation, I know that that is a chemical that is used as an irritant to help protect the Asian lady beetle from other critters. Box elder bugs, the one thing, again, true bugs often do have scent glands, and scent glands are often, again, a defense mechanism. So although maybe you won't define it as a true toxic, you know, make you die type of thing, I could not rule out that box elder bugs have enough in those glands that might have irritated the animal's digestive system. So, yeah, eating bugs, even when we try it for people, can be a little bit tricky because it's not just the bug. It depends what the bug eats, because sometimes the bug is picking up plant chemicals and putting it in. So it gets complicated, but it makes a lot of sense to me that the box elder bugs did cause the animal to get sick.
Marilyn emailed us with a photo. She found this critter on her farm outside of Beaver Dam last year. She couldn't find it in her bug book and wonders if you identify it.
So the critter is a type of long-horned wood-boring beetle, but this one is called the pine sawyer, spelled S-A-W-Y-E-R, associated with dead pine and spruce trees. We see it in firewood quite a bit also. Big, long antennae, big, scary-looking thing. There is a Asian species of this, the Asian longhorn beetle that attacks maple trees, which was a bit of a concern, but really has not gotten crazy in the Midwest. So this is, I think, one of the native sawyer beetles and really a very distinctive creature. And again, its antennae are twice as long as the critter. And all told, we're talking about an animal that's about 3 inches long.
And Linda emailed us a picture of a bug and wonders what it was as well, kind of greenish with a...
Sure. So this is an immature stink bug. I'm guessing it's a green stink bug, but it's, you know, really very photographic because it's got those orange stripes on the shoulder and the different spots and whatnot. So, again, it's just an immature stink bug, which technically we would call a nymph, and it would look as somewhat the same shape but a different, totally green when it turns into the adult critter.
And I think with that, we're out of time. We had lots of more emails. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them, Phil, but it's always a pleasure to have you come by. Thanks so much for being with us. And let me know when you ever get that book of yours finished.
It's good for people to prod me because I need prodding.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. We'll get him back. Speaking of books, don't forget that our book club is on tomorrow. This time we'll be talking with Ron Rindo and his book. It's a great book. It's titled Breathing Lake Superior. It's a novel, and you're going to enjoy listening to him. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.